So the last course section we're going to look at in the course before we start giving you some resources, wrapping up and sort of finishing up what we started, is incident handling. Incident handling is becoming more and more a critical foundational piece of security programs, especially in target-rich environments. I remember 20 years ago, if organizations did a really good job with prevention, they did really good job with locking down of their systems, the chances of an incident occurring were pretty slim, and the impact wasn't that large, so you could actually get away with not having incident response or incident handling components within your environment. However, today, with the amount of advanced targeted attacks and the amount of damage they can cause, having a plan to contain and control the damage is critical, and that's what incident handling is all about. The idea of incident handling is a simple premise. If somebody starts doing harm to your organization, the sooner you can detect and the sooner you can react, the less damage there will be overall. So if we look at the general concept of an attack, this is the start and this is the stop. The further we go in, the more damage. So the idea is if we can go in and we can detect an incident here and respond and control it here, that's going to be a lot less damage than if I go in and wait till here to react and take action. So the longer we allow an attack to occur without noticing or taking action, the more damage is going to be caused. So incident handling is all about having a plan to be able to respond quickly to those incidents. Now, important, incident handling, there's really two pieces here. This is the detect, and this is the response piece. What we're focusing on here is this. However, in order for response to be effective at reducing damage, it's relying on proper detection. So all the things we've been talking about this week of outbound traffic, and I said look for anomalies in the number of connections, the length of the connection, and the amount of data that's leaving the environment, all of those things are critical because having a plan to respond quickly to put out the fire is important, but you need to make sure you have some way of detecting that there's a fire. So think of incident handling as the fire department. Having a group of people that are on call, well-trained with proper equipment, ready to deploy to put out a fire in a building is really, really important, but it's only going to be effective if there's a fire alarm, a smoke detector, or ways to detect the fire. If there's no way to detect a fire in the building, then the firefighters are going to be sitting there at the firehouse not doing anything and not responding because they weren't able to detect it. So that's the same thing. Incident response is the firefighting component, but we need to make sure that we have the smoke alarms and the fire detectors properly set up so we can detect to allow the response team to take action to minimize damage. And as we mentioned, in this day and age, no matter what you do, you will be targeted, you will be broken into, you will be compromised. That's true of all organizations, but the higher worth your assets, the more likely you're going to be targeted. So if we go in and we look at different types of retail stores, if you have a store that's a convenience store selling beverages and chips and snacks, yeah, they could be robbed. But if they get robbed, the overall impact is minimal. So the amount of energy they're going to put in alarm systems is a lot less than a really, really fine jewelry store that if they get robbed would cost potentially millions upon millions of dollars of loss. So the more high worth your assets, the more critical the response. So while I always talk about IR, by the way, it's incident handling, but we always call it IR, incident response. They're synonymous terms. So if I use that just out of habit, when we talk about IR, it's always important in any class, but in ICS with critical infrastructure, because of the high worth nature of those targets, it's going to become a critical piece of the equation. So we're going to look at our process, some of the mistakes, and a little twist of legal aspects associated with incident handling. If time is not on our side, and the longer it takes us to respond and deal with the more damage, what do we want to do to minimize any delays and maximize the efficiency of our process? We want to have a standard process that we do over and over and over again. We want to have well thought out specific steps that we constantly do on a regular basis. Because if we're trained on a process, we're going to be more efficient and less prone to errors than if we're just making it up as we go along. So therefore, the key to incident response is having a well thought out documented process, which is known as a 6-step process. By the way, this 6-step process is not SANS's process. This process was actually developed for critical infrastructure. It was developed in the utility energy sector by a really, really dear friend of mine, Gene Schultz. Unfortunately, Gene Schultz passed away a few years ago, so we lost one of the really brilliant people in cybersecurity. Not only was he one of the brilliant people and a mentor to me, but he was also a good friend. So I always think of him when I think of this chart. But Gene Schultz is the one who came up with this process. He worked across a lot of utility companies and said, okay, what are the common components and threads that are needed in order to properly handle an incident? So preparation. You need to make sure you have a plan, you have executive buy-in, you have support, you have the resources you need. Identification. You need to have a way to detect and identify that there's an incident. Once you identify an incident, you want to stabilize the environment, containment. You want to make sure the problem doesn't get any worse. If you did firefighting. When I went to college, where I grew up was in a rural area. So we had volunteer firefighters. We didn't have full-time folks. And I used to do volunteer firefighting. And when you showed up to a building that was on fire, you didn't go in and start putting out the fire. What you did is you assessed the current fire. You looked at the building and you set up boundaries to stop the fire from spreading and getting any worse. So you literally would sometimes go in and break down wood or barriers and start squirting water in to contain the fire. And then once the fire was contained, then you would actually start putting it out. If you watch any pictures of fire, of forest fires, when they go to deal with the forest fire, they go and they start clearing all the wood. And they start putting a water boundary to make sure that the fire can't get any worse. Then they try to deal with the fire. If you focus on dealing with the fire, it could spread and got a lot worse. If you contain it and then you deal with it, at least you fenced off the problem. So that's often a mistake that we see with new incident handlers. When they go in during an incident, they immediately want to start putting out the fire. And I'm like, no, no, no. Step back, assess, and stabilize. Contain the problem and make sure it doesn't get any worse. And then once you contain the problem, then you go in and fight the fire. Then you go in and start fixing it. Because if you skip step 3 and you jump right to eradication or fixing it, as you're fixing it, it could get worse and worse and worse. I'll give you a perfect example of this. Back in 2000, many companies were still immature in incident response. And one of their first big test cases in many organizations was I love you virus. That was sort of one of the real big tests of many of our clients. Well, what did many of our clients do? They immediately went into their mail server and they started cleaning up the accounts. So they started removing the I love you virus from all the different accounts on the system, and they would be working for 3 hours. They would get 90% done. And what would happen? Somebody came into work, clicked on it, and poof, everything was back infected again. So they didn't have to start over again. So then they spent 3.5 hours individually cleaning everything up, and they got 95%, and somebody came in, click, and poof, the whole thing again. And after 2 or 3 times, they would call us up and say, how do we solve this? I said, pull the mail server offline. Contain the problem. Once the mail server is offline, then clean it up. And then once you're 100%, then put it back online again. If you don't contain the problem, exactly what happened the last 3 times will keep occurring is as you're fixing it in line, the problem will spread and keep getting worse and worse and worse. So that was a lesson where people learned quickly, when you have viruses, you pull the mail server containment and then you clean up the mailboxes, because if you don't pull the mail server, the problem can keep spreading and spreading. Then once we contain the problem, we then fix the problem. Make sure the adversary doesn't get in. Today, step 4 is the step everyone likes skipping. Why? If you're down for 10 to 15 hours, what is any executive going to be saying? Get my systems back up now. Stop that. Just get them back up. Get them running again. So organizations often will just rebuild their systems from the original build and put them back online. Well, guess what? If you have a secure build and that server got broken into, and you have an incident and you do nothing to fix, all you do is take the original secure build and you put it back on your box. Well, guess what? If that was the original build that they got in, you might want to look up in a dictionary, but I don't think your definition of secure build means what you think it means, because it's not secure if it was broken into once. And let me ask you a question. If I have a build that was broken into once by an adversary, and I put that exact same build with no changes back on my network, what do you think is going to happen? I know it's a trick question. You're going to get broken into again. You're going to get reinfected. So one of the huge problems we're seeing with our clients today is failure to prevent reinfection, because they're so focused on recovery that they skip eradication. They don't fix the problem. And if the adversary got in once, they'll get in a second, a third, and a fourth time. Then once you fix the problem, you then want to recover your data, get your system back up, verified, and then put it online. And then you want to monitor and make sure the adversary doesn't get back in. And then you want to perform a lessons learned, which is really focused in on 2 areas. One, it's improving the process. You want to optimize your incident response capability. I don't do dedicated IR like I used to. 5+ years ago, I used to run dedicated IR teams, and then I had to make a decision whether I did that or I taught, and I decided I enjoy teaching enough to switch, because you can't teach and do dedicated IR. Simple. If a client calls you for IR, you have to respond within 3 hours. If they called me on Wednesday of this week and I said, yeah, I just started a class in Singapore, I'll be there on Tuesday. You let your building burn for 5 days, right? It's not going to work there. So I still do limited IR support, but I used to run teams for 3 to 4 years. And I'll tell you, at the end of it, it was hard to walk away, because the one team I ran, after working together for 4 years, we were a well-oiled machine, because we worked on so many incidents and did so many lessons learned and kept improving and optimizing and improving and optimizing. We had such a well thought out process there. So you got to recognize you're always going to make mistakes during an incident. and you constantly got to improve the process as a team. And then the second part of lessons learned, you have to put together an executive report. You have to explain at a high level what occurred, why it occurred, and how you're going to remediate. Now, be super careful during that. Lessons learned is a very, very interesting area. Because on the one hand, when you have an incident and you outbrief the executives at the end of an incident, what is almost always their response? How much do you need to make sure this doesn't happen again? Typically, after there's an incident, the budget is open and the money flows. That's why a lot of folks will often say the best thing that ever happened to our organization is we had an incident, because that finally woke up the executive's eyes and they gave us all the money we needed. So there is a hidden positive, but here's the negative. Don't ever make a promise you can't deliver on. One of the biggest mistakes I see IR folks say is when the executives say, how much do you need to make sure this doesn't happen again? And they go in and say, $5 million. Boom. What's the problem? You just signed your death sentence, because the executive literally meant make sure it never happens again. So you just told the executives, if they give you $5 million, you will guarantee this will never happen again. I know that's not what you think you said. That's what they heard. And then when a breach does occur, you most likely will lose your job or lose your position. So what I always say is, when they go in and say, how much do you need to make sure this will never happen again? I say, we can't. But if you give us $5 million, I can reduce the chances and increase our detection capability and minimize the damage by 70% if this does occur again. That I can deliver on. So make sure that after that breach and you do the lessons learned, the executives are willing to give you money, but make sure you recognize what they're giving the money and what promises you're making. Because if you promise that this will never happen again, that is a career-limiting move. You cannot deliver on that promise. So be super careful in your communication. So let's take a look through each of these. Preparation. Make sure you have a way to communicate, not using the compromised infrastructure. One of the number one rules of incident handling: assume that your adversary is better, faster, quicker, and smarter than you. If you assume that your adversary is better, faster, quicker, and smarter, you will have a good incident. The mistake that is often made is during an incident, people assume that they're smarter and better and faster than their adversary, and they make critical mistakes. If your network has been compromised, assume the entire network is compromised. Use out-of-band communication during the incident. Don't use email. Don't use any network. Don't use VoIP. Don't use any of the critical infrastructure. Assume that your entire network is compromised and have total and complete out-of-band communication. When we used to do large-scale utility-based incident response, we actually have burn phones, computers, and an out-of-band mail server that we used during the incident. So we would literally go in to the key executives. We would give them a burn phone and a laptop and say, anything involving this incident, you use that device. You don't use your corporate phone. You don't use your personal phone. You don't use your laptop. You use these two clean systems for anything involving this incident and no other communication mechanism. Total, complete, out-of-band communication. Then make sure you get the executive support. During an incident, you need to have all the approval to do whatever is necessary to resolve the incident. If you have to be during the incident running back to your executives saying, can I do this? Can I do this? Can I do this? There's two problems. One, very, very inefficient, very, very slow. Second, question for you. How long does it take your executives to make a decision? A long time. It's not instantaneous, which means if time is not on your side and you have damage occurring and you need your executives to make a decision and it takes them 4 hours, that is 4 hours of wasted time. They need to make the decision ahead of time. You need to get their buy-in up front, and we need to get the rules of engagement finalized so we have the approval to perform the actions that are necessary. Then build up contacts with law enforcement, legal, and PR. So this way, when an incident occurs, you already have the relationships, and carefully select team members. And I'll let you in on a secret. Don't select team members on technical skills. Biggest mistake. I can train anybody on the technical skills. However, to be good at incident handling, you need two personality traits, and I can't change your personality. Either you have those personality traits or you don't, but I can't change your personality, but I can teach you the technical skills. When I ran my incident response team, the managers thought I was nuts because most of the people that I hired didn't have the technical skills that were needed, but they had the personality. So they gave me a list of candidates, and I had a bunch of candidates that had the right skills but not the right personality, had the right personality but not the skills. I'll take that any day of the week because I can train you up, but I can't change your personality. The two personality traits you must have to work on incident handling is, one, you must be able to stay calm under pressure. When all around you is deteriorating and getting out of control, you must be able to stay calm, focused, and be able to deliver in high-stress situations. Not many people have that. That's one of those, I don't know why, but I just stay fairly calm. This is calm, Eric. This is upset, Eric. You sort of get what you get. I always sort of joke is, I don't get upset, I get even. So if you go in and get me mad right now, I'm joking there. But the point is, you want people who can stay focused and continue to deliver. And honestly, to be a SANS instructor, that is a trait you need, because things can go wrong at conferences. You could have things deteriorating, and you literally just got to stand there and deliver as that's the case. I have friends of mine, brilliant, brilliant folks. They get stressed out very easily. They get very upset. They get very bothered. They get very emotional. That's great. You're not going to do good in incident handling. You got to be able to work very well in high stress situations. Second, you got to be a team player. You got to be a we person, not an I person. If you care about yourself, you care about getting the credit, and you care about getting the awards, don't play an IR. IR is a team sport. You got to care more about yourself than anyone else. It's not about whether you win or lose, but whether the team wins or lose. If you look at a sports analogy, it doesn't matter if I score the winning goal as long as I help my team score the winning goal. The team wins and loses, not the individual. IR is a team sport. One of my best friends, he's still my best friend, Matt, one of the most brilliant guys I know. When I get stuck on a problem, when I can't answer a question, Matt is the guy I usually call, and he usually knows the answer. He came to me 8 years ago and says, Eric, I want to do incident response. I should have known better, but because he's a good friend and a smart guy, I put him on my IR team. Matt only cares about himself. Matt doesn't care about the team. Could care less. And he's got to get the credit. He's a nice guy, but he's just a me type of person. So we're on this incident, and I notice one of the team members asks Matt for some information, and he gives him wrong information. So I go over and I'm like, Matt, I'm calling you out, but you just gave John some bad data. I said, can I ask you why? He goes, he's about to solve the case and I need to solve it before him. So I had to send him off the trail a little bit and give him some false information. I said, Matt, take your hands off the keyboard. I'm firing you. And he goes, what? And I explained to him that this is a team sport and you need to care more about the team. And he goes, yes, you should fire me. And we're still good friends today. I put him in a bad spot. That's just not who he is. So when you build IR teams, focus on personality of team and people who can handle stress and the technical skills you can teach them afterwards. But don't focus on the technical skills, because many, many technical people typically don't handle stress very well. And many technical people aren't team players. So it's almost a contradiction where if you look at my incident response team, we were a very effective incident response team. Most of them were not typical technical backgrounds or computer science, because that's not the personality trait that usually breeds that level. They're usually other disciplines that you need to pull in to train those skill sets. So just keep in mind personality versus technical skills. Then make sure you take care of your team. Incident response is a high burnout sport. Even if you have the personality to handle stress, when you're working on an incident, you're sometimes up for 70 to 80 hours with minimal sleep, way too much caffeine, and not enough showers in between. So if you don't carefully rest up and take care of those team members, they can get burnt out very, very quickly. Then I know that fourth bullet violates every security bone in your body, because we're always trained on you don't write down passwords, you don't write down crypto keys. But guess what? During an incident, you need to get into those systems and you must have the key passwords and crypto keys archived, because there could be loss of life and that might be the only way into the system. Now, I often get asked, how do you archive that information in a secure manner off-site, but still accessible during an incident? I don't like this answer, but I don't know anything better. So this is what we do with our clients. I'm still searching for something better, but so far this is the most scalable solution I can find. What does every executive, every manager, and IT person have and have with them almost 24/7, and many of us sleep with it on our nightstand? A smartphone, a cell phone. So if I need to have those passwords and crypto keys available 24/7 and accessible from key executives that are going to be on site, the best way to make sure it's with them all the time is to go in and have a secure application that encrypts with a password or biometrics on their smartphone. Literally what I do is I go to the executives and I say, give me your phone. And they say, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm installing applications. I'm installing the passwords and the crypto keys. Never access this. Never do anything. And by the way, if you ever buy a new phone, let me know so I can reload the application. And I said, but at least now when there's an incident and you show up, because the executives will always be there when there's money, I say, give me your phone, swipe your finger, and I have the keys and passwords that I need. So I typically will pick 4 or 5 key members of the executive, manager, and IT staff, people that I know that are not at the facility. So if there's loss of life, they're most likely not going to be impacted, but they'll still be available during an incident. And I put the information on their phone in a secure manner, because that's with them all the time. Like I said, I don't like the solution, but I haven't found anything better. Because if you store things in safes or offsite or banks, that's not 24/7. If you tell people to remember things, they'll forget. If you give them paper, they'll lose it. So far, that seems to be, unfortunately, the most scalable method for accomplishing that. Then you want to create your jump bags. Now, we call it a jump bag. This is from the military terminology of a paratrooper. But really, our jump bags are not bags. They're cases. And if you've never seen a Pelican case, take a look at our man, Derek. This is a Pelican case. A Pelican case is a special case. It's plastic and it's packed correctly with styrofoam that if you go in and put everything in there correctly, you literally can throw that box across the room and nothing inside will break. And the jump bag is everything we need to handle the incident. Cables, switches, licensing keys, batteries, flashlights, backup systems, batteries, anything you could possibly need to handle the incident goes in that jump bag, and then you bring the jump bag with you. The general rule of a jump bag is simple. It's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it. So when I used to work incident response, we had 3 jump bags. I'll be honest with you. 90% of all incidents we worked on, we never broke open 2 of the jump bags. We had 1 primary and then 2 with secondary components. Most of the incidents, we only used the first jump bag. Why do we bring the other 2? Because in the 10% where we did open them up, if we didn't have it, it would have caused a 20 to 30 hour delay in order to get the equipment. So it's better to bring it with you and not need it than need it and not have it. But Eric, can't you just go to the store and pick up the information that you want? I'm in the middle of Alaska at 3 a.m. in the morning working on an outage situation. What store is going to be open? What store is going to be located? Where am I going to go to? In another case, it was 11 p.m. I'm on the USS Roosevelt in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. What store are you going to go to? There's not one. So it's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it. You always want to go in and have everything ready to handle that incident. Then you wait for the call and you determine whether you have an incident. Now, just so we're clear here, sometimes this step can be instantaneous. So if I pull up to my client's data center and there's flames coming out of the roof, yes, step 2 is complete. Let's move to step 3. If I go in and my client gets a call from the Federal Bureau of Investigations saying that their facility has been compromised by a foreign adversary and they have proof and valid data to show it, yeah, that step is done at that point. So sometimes identification is instantaneous based on what you're dealing with. Sometimes it can take weeks or months to perform. So it all depends on the type of incident you're dealing with. But during identification, you want to look at all the information. You want to correlate all the data and you want to make sure that you can determine whether there is a problem. If there's any area where you can make positive strides, it's in step 2. In control system environments, on average, there's 426 days from compromise to detection. Typically, I always do things in months, but days works. It's typically 14 to 15 months from when compromise occurs to when you detect. So there's huge room for improvement here where you can greatly contain and control the damage by detecting a lot quicker. Now, the trick with identification is you want to go in and you want to make sure you're giving accurate information to the executives. Don't oversell them and don't undersell them. Tell them what you know. At this point, here's what we know. Here's where we're at. Here's what we're going to do. I'll call you in 2 hours. And in every 2 hours, I call and give you an update until it escalates into an incident or we close it out on our system. Also, be careful of who you notify. Because remember, during the early stages of an incident, you don't know what you're dealing with. You might be dealing with an inside job. You might have someone inside your facility who's deliberately or accidentally causing harm. So if you start telling everyone, oh yeah, I think we got an incident here, you might be tipping your hand to the adversary and they now might start to clean up, cover their tracks, and make your job a lot harder. During identification, you always want to send your best handler. And the reason is, this is a very, very difficult task. You need to go in and determine if there's an incident without modifying or altering anything. Because if you go in and start modifying and altering changes on systems and you have an incident, congratulations. You've just corrupted your evidence. So you got to be real careful of preserving and protecting the information that's in place in order that if it does turn into an incident, all your evidence is properly preserved. Then, if it turns out it is an incident, then the first thing you want to do is stabilize the environment. Now, here is where there are some significant differences in control systems. First, in a traditional IT arena, what do you normally do when you have compromised systems? You do a binary backup for forensic evidence to look for signs and indications of an attack on that system. Well, what's the problem? How do you do a binary backup of a PLC? How do you do a binary backup of an RTU? You don't. They don't have those components. That's not how they're set up. So in a lot of cases, the nature of the devices that you're dealing with in control systems doesn't always lend itself to be able to do binary backups of those devices. Second difference, in traditional IT environments, the standard way of doing containment is to physically isolate the system off the network, is to go in and disconnect it from the network, plug it into a hub or a switch for monitoring purposes in the environment. Problem in control systems. First, you don't always have physical access to the devices. Those devices can be in data centers, they could be in colos, they can be far, far away. So you're not going to always be able to physically go in and grab that. Second, if you start going in to a control system environment that's running critical infrastructure processing and you start pulling cables, that's high risk. Because not only you might pull the wrong cable, but you might not plug everything back in the way it was. If you've ever been to some of these large operation centers, they are not always neatly wired. These sometimes look like a big bowl of colorful spaghetti, and you can't always trace wires. And I'll tell you, some of these machines are really old. I've been in cases where a machine is working perfectly. I go to disconnect the cable, and literally, because it's so old and deteriorated, I rip the cable out of the connector. Literally, the wires are sort of worn out, frayed, that literally, if you tug too much, you actually broke the cable, and now you just created a bigger problem. So for all of those reasons, we don't like doing physical containment and control systems. It tends to never work out well and not be positive. So what we do is we do virtual containment. Virtual containment virtually contains the environment without touching any of the physical cabling. Now let's look at our goal. What is containment? Stabilizing the environment. How do you stabilize during an incident? What are your two goals? A, making sure the adversary is not in your network. And B, making sure whatever is wrong doesn't spread or get any worse. So how do we do virtual containment? We're going to make sure the adversary is out via our firewall, and we're going to make sure it's on a separate VLAN and can't spread via our switch configuration. But great, if I'm going to be now going in and changing firewall configs and switches to do virtual containment, now that's also potentially risky, because how do I make sure it was back the way it was? Simple. I take a backup of my firewall config and my switch, and I do a cryptographic hash against it. Then I modify the firewall to keep the adversary out, and I modify the switch to put it on a separate isolated VLAN. Then when the incident is done, I take the original firewall config, the original switch config, I put it back, I snap a cryptographic hash and I compare, and now I can verifiable prove that it was exactly the way it was before the incident. That's not something I can do with physical containment. So that is the one twist that we get into ICS, is we typically do a virtual containment for the reasons I mentioned. There's another twist. Typically, in control systems, when you identify an incident, you might not have the resources and the ability to contain immediately. You might not have the approval. It might be too risky, or you might not have enough information to know what's going on. So typically in control systems, while it is a little risky, we often add a step in here called watch and learn. Essentially, what we're saying is we've confirmed we have an incident. We know we're compromised, but we don't have enough details, enough information, or we need more info to take legal action. So we're going to actually just watch the adversary, learn more about what they're doing before we contain the environment. Because what we forget is containing the environment is altering your systems. As soon as you do that, what are you doing? You're telling the attacker that you just caught him. So you got to be cautious in critical infrastructure that as soon as you notify the adversary, they might do multiple things. They might start destroying systems to cover their tracks. They might do alternative attack vectors, or they might dig deeper into your network so you can't find them. So you have to recognize that containment is going in and giving an indication back to the adversary that you caught them, and that could have adverse impact. Therefore, many control systems, we need to build up and get a real solid case before we start doing anything to tip our hand to the adversary to make sure that we're really in a stabilized state to clean up the environment. So most of the time when we're doing incident response and control systems, we're typically going to watch and learn for 2 to 3 months before we go to the containment. With that said, that is very high risk for two reasons. One, you're in essence watching and allowing somebody to cause harm, which means your liability profile just increased exponentially. Because now, if you're a utility company and you're providing service to customers, and the customers find out that you knew about an attack and you allowed it to continue for 6 months and that caused significant harm to them, you could have large class action suits and lawsuits against you. So this is a high risk area that can increase your liability, but it also is a necessary evil in this domain space. But my recommendation to you, that's not your decision. This has to be at an executive. When I'm doing incident response and I get customers say, Eric, we need you to make the decision if we should watch and learn. And I look at them and say, there's not enough money in your bank account for me to make that decision. Because if I did, I now have all the liability and I'm not going there. So I'll make a recommendation. I'll guide you and consult you. You're making the call though. You're going to decide whether you do that or not. So once again, that's another big difference. We normally don't like watch and learn in traditional IT because of the liability, but in control systems, because of the risk factor, it's unfortunately a necessary evil. So I wanted to throw that in there for you. Then once we contain the problem, then we need to fix the problem. I want you to all write in big letters on this slide, do not skip the step. This is the step that everyone skips because, oh, I'll just restore from original build, put it back online. This is one you got to trust me. It's better to be down for 20 more hours and fix the problem than be up 20 hours sooner and get reinfected. Because I'll tell you, when you get reinfected, it's going to be a lot more than 20 hours. And that's the problem. When we get to this step, we found the adversary, we stabilized the environment, the executives say, how much longer? And I say, it's going to be about 20 more hours. Forget it. Just put the systems back up online. I'll save the 20 hours. No, you're not. You either pay now or you pay later. And paying later is going to cost you a lot more. Trust me on this one. Do it right the first time, because a reinfection is always worse and always causes a lot more issues. Figure out how the adversary got in, fix the problem, improve your defenses, secure the enterprise, and then put it back up and running. Caveat to ICS. In control system environments, you sometimes do not have the luxury to take systems offline or to wait 20 hours for it to be down. If you're talking about mission critical operations, you sometimes operating at a 50% capacity is better than zero. So even if you're infected and compromised, operating in a less efficient state is sometimes a necessity. So what we sometimes have to do is what we call parallel eradication, which is we're going to go in and we're going to allow the compromised systems to continue to operate in production, because 50% is better than zero. And I cannot pull, the capabilities will be so devastating that I need to keep the availability. So I have a team that monitors that unstable process to make sure it doesn't get worse. And we have another team that's very quickly building, fixing, and securing a new alternative. We verify, we test it, and then when it's ready to go, we run it in parallel. We pull down the infected. We then clean up the infected. Then we put that back and pull down the temporary. So sometimes in control systems, you just don't have the luxury to take down your environment for 20 hours. You don't have the luxury of pulling a compromised system. So in those cases, you would do a watch and learn to make sure that the unstable process doesn't get more unstable. And then we have a secondary team that builds. It tends to be more expensive, but necessary in certain areas. So once again, a lot of this extra stuff, if you're in IT, ignore, because it doesn't apply. But in control systems, we have a lot of varieties that we got to deal with and play with here in order to make that work. So either fix or do an offline fix and run in parallel. However you need to do it, you must fix the problem long term. You cannot have a system with known exposures up and running for a long period, because guess what? If the adversary got in once, they'll get in again. One other quick caveat, and then I'll take the question. In IT, we always fix the problem. So in a traditional IT environment, if a server gets compromised, I'm going to secure the server. I'm going to lock down the server. I'm going to fix the server. In control systems, you might not be able to. We just worked on an incident in August where the problem was there was a piece of equipment that was missing a critical patch. We couldn't apply the patch. Why? The patch crashed the box. So we had a solution. We either secured the box and it crashed, or we kept it open. But we knew it had visibility from outside networks, and we knew it would keep getting broken into over and over again. So what did we do? We actually put a specialized firewall with specialized signatures that would block traffic to that specific port with certain characteristics. So this way, nobody could run that exploit against it. We did like a WAF, a web application, a customized firewall just for that device to filter out any of the commands. So a lot of times in control systems, your eradication is going to be remediation controls, not primary, because you can't just fix the problem. So you come up with sometimes these kludgy solutions, but you really don't have any other option available in order to fix it in a reasonable manner. So the question is, and that sort of ties to the last thing I covered, is what if we have a situation where zero-day exploit, brand new virus, and there is no fix? That there is no way we can fix the system. The system needs to run in its state anything we try to do to fix would cause it to go down. You then have the two options. The option one I just said is a remediating measure. Put some other solution in place to try to go in and limit or reduce the visibility of that system on the network. The second option that we always have to keep in mind is security is all about risk. So I have had cases where we have gone to the executive team and we've presented the case saying, listen, here's the situation. This device does have this exposure. There is no way to fix it today. We can put these other solutions, but they're very expensive. Are you willing to accept that risk that this might get compromised again? Or do you want us to continue searching for other remediation measures in place? And depending on the likelihood and the impact, you will sometimes have executives saying they're willing to accept that risk, and then you document it. We also have cases where we will work with the vendor, and the vendor will say, it will take us 3 months to deploy a fix for that, and all other solutions are not feasible. So in that case, once again, you'd go to the executives with the vendor and say, is this acceptable? With one of our clients, what the vendor actually did is the vendor hired a 3-month monitoring service to monitor those devices. So if somebody tried to break in, they would know about it, and then they rolled out the fix 3 months later. So you're sometimes going to go and come up with these one-off solutions, which I know traditionally in security is not what we want, but in control systems, you sometimes have to get creative or just be willing to accept the risk. The trick is brief the executive team. They got to be involved in these decisions, and they got to be aware of whether this does or does not make sense. Then once we fix the problem or decide to accept the problem, we then want to recover our systems, get them back up and running, and put the data back on the box. Please, please, please be careful here. Recovery is late in the process. You're often very tired at this point, and it's very easy to reinfect the system. I have seen cases where we have been working on an incident for 4 to 5 days, minimal sleep, and when the folks went to recover the system, they inadvertently reinfected the box and put the malware or vulnerability back on the system. Here's another unique ICS trick. When we're doing traditional IT incident response, it's typically 3 to 4 days. You're a little tired, but you're functioning. It's not uncommon with control system response that it might last for 7 or 8 days. I don't know about you, but after about 3 or 4 days that I'm not getting a lot of sleep and I'm overdosed on caffeinated beverages, I'm not thinking real clearly. I'm not really in a good optimal state. So now you have a group of people that can barely walk straight across the room, and you're after 80 hours of minimal sleep. You're now going to have them do a very high risk process that, if goes wrong, defeats all the work you've just worked on for the last 4 to 5 days. So what I'll typically do in control system recovery is I'll have a secondary team on call. So I'll have a group of folks that have been sleeping, eating, and showering during that time period, and I'll keep them in check, and then they'll show up and they'll perform this step for us. Now, the primary team is still there to oversee it, but now I have people that are alert, awake, and on their game, and they're now going to go in, restore and verify, and monitor the system to make sure the adversary doesn't get back in. They're going to complement, not replace, but complement with additional brain power my exhausted, tired team, and I find that works great. It's a beautiful thing in control systems. So that's another trick when you're working on a really, really long incident, which is indicative of control systems, having a secondary team that comes to support you at the very end to add in additional brain power is a very, very smart thing to do. Then once you recover and verify the system, you're then going to do a lessons learned. lessons learned is putting together an executive report and working with your team to improve your process. Be very careful here. My recommendation is when you write the executive report, have an attorney in the room review anything before you write. Here's why. Your lessons learned report will be evidence if this goes to litigation. And I've seen really terrible reports that put the company at risk because they weren't written correctly. Let me give you a real quick lesson on rules of evidence. It's a weird, weird area. Nobody is forcing you to create evidence. No one's forcing you to write a report. So I don't have to write a report. And if I don't write a report, there's nothing to be used as evidence in court. However, if I decide to write a report, once the report is created, if it's reviewed later to determine it's bad, I can't delete it. I can't alter it. I can't modify it. So the interesting thing about rules of evidence is no one's forcing you to generate evidence, but once you create the evidence, you can't ever delete it or remove it afterwards, which means be careful of everything you write. Because I've worked on cases where I thought we were going to win. I read the lessons learned executive report and I'm like, we're going to lose because it's so poorly written. So just remember, no one's forcing you to generate a report, but once the report is generated, you can't remove or delete it afterwards. So have that attorney in the room reviewing every word you write. Typically, if I do expert witness work and I'm writing a high-end expert report, I'll sometimes have three attorneys that are watching and we're discussing and talking to make sure that it's clearly articulated the way that you want. So that's another trick I learned. Have an attorney in the room as you write that report. I covered a lot of these big mistakes. The first big mistake is right here, not fixing the problem. Failure to prevent reinfection is by far the number one mistake out there. The second biggest mistake we see is what I call failure to think litigation. Essentially, it's the mindset of, oh, we're not going to litigate. We've never litigated. We've never gone to court. I'm not going to preserve evidence. I'm not going to protect evidence. I'm not going to keep evidence. And then you have to go to court and you have no evidence and you now have potential liability brought against you or your company. So always assume it's going to go to court. Remember, it's better to assume litigation and have evidence and not need it than need it and not have it. So properly protecting your evidence, properly creating clear, concise notes that help, don't hurt the company. And then the third mistake that's tied into that is creating sloppy evidence that puts your organization at risk. Not thinking that this is going to be used in a court and writing really misleading, incorrect, subjective reports that end up doing a lot more harm than good. Now, when we talk about incident handling, it very often assumes that there are laws that have been broken or legal issues associated with it. Most countries have two general types of law, criminal and civil, because a lot of this was created off of the original English law system that a lot of countries have adapted. It's important to recognize that there's different types of laws and big differences between criminal and civil. The most important ones to remember is criminal is the only one that will have incarceration, jail. Civil, typically there's restitution of damages, but there's not any jail associated with it. The second thing that's real important is the burden of proof. How much proof do you need to show to get a successful ruling? In criminal, the burden of proof is beyond reasonable doubt. That is, you're 99% sure they did it. In civil, the burden of proof is a preponderance of the evidence. What's a preponderance of the evidence? Tip the scale, 50.1%. That's a pretty big difference. So to win in civil, you only have to have 50.1% confidence in the evidence. And to win in criminal, you have to have 99%. So we've seen cases where clients had evidence that was about 80% sure they did it, and they're trying to go the criminal route. And I'm like, you're much better civil, because it's a pretty big difference in the burden of proof in terms of the ability to win. Once again, it's important for you to understand that there are differences, but you would really work with the legal experts, the lawyers and the attorneys, in order to make sure that you're making the right decisions for the company. Some of the lessons learned from working in these cases is many control system incidents are really escalation or IT incidents that got out of control. Because look at our diagram. Most of the ways into your network are through your business. So in a lot of cases, a lot of the attacks we've seen on HMIs and control systems were really traditional IT incidents that either got out of control, got escalated, or didn't get resolved, which means if you can work with your IT, IR team, and help better build up their support, that can minimize a lot of the control system incidents that are occurring out there. Also, as I showed you as we went through this process, control system incident response is a different animal than IT incident response. There's some overlap, but there's a lot of critical differences. And I've seen a lot of companies hire traditional IR folks to do control system response, and it ends up ending real, real bad because they make a lot more mistakes. Like I said, I learned a long time ago with the virtual containment, where we were at a client where during IT, disconnecting a cable is simple. Well, I've learned disconnecting a cable of a system that's near the sea with a lot of salt water around it that hasn't been unplugged for 15 years is anything but simple. You might never get those cables back together. And then if you do break it, they might not make those parts anymore. They might not be available. So those are some of the stuff where it can get out of hand pretty quickly and pretty fast if you're not careful. And obviously, there's going to be a lot of regulation around incident handling, making sure that you know when to report incidents,